This evening is the first of this series of classes, which I grabbed this title Then and Now out of thin air. The idea has come for this class came from a number of requests we'd really like to learn something about Tibetan Buddhism, not just about meditation practice. And so we're going to work with some texts, but one of the aspects of Tibetan Buddhism is that it developed in for a pre-modern, agricultural, semi-nomadic society. And we live in a post-modern, post-industrial, multicultural society. And these are very, very different circumstances. And time and time again, I found myself in the process of translating from one instruction and perspective from that culture to this culture. So that's basically what we're going to try to do here, is work with texts or work with teachings which, at the very least, are 1,000 years old. Many of them are much, much older than that, but nothing we'll work with is more recent than 1,000 years ago. Take these teachings and ways of approaching practice, ways of approaching life in a certain sense, and explore and see how to understand and how to work with them in the context of our own culture. So this is not about trying to go back to another age or create another situation, but how to bring these things forward into this set of circumstances. Traditionally, there are three ways of approaching or developing an understanding, and they're usually referred to as listening, thinking, and meditating. I like to translate those as study, reflection, and practice. In early times, the only way you actually were able to study something was to listen to somebody very, very carefully, because you usually didn't have access to a text. There just weren't any texts to have access to, so you had to listen very carefully. Today we have not only books all over the place, we also have the internet and all kinds of other resources, so we have our own ability to study. Through study we develop a conceptual and intellectual understanding, which is the basis that's helpful. You know, like, we understand the stuff. But then we enter a second stage, in which is we actually think about this, think about it until reflect on it, roll it over and over, until it makes sense to us, which is different from just learning the material. You chew on it until it actually makes sense to you, and then you cultivate it through meditation practice, so that it really becomes part of you, you remove whatever's inside you that prevents you from living that directly. So we're going to be working primarily in the context of this class with the first two, because practice just takes a lot more time. In terms of how to put this stuff into practice, this is the book I recommend. Because it just happens to have been written by somebody in this room, but this lays out the practices quite clearly for a modern context. But one of the things I will expect of all of you is that you put some effort from week to week in actually learning this material. You don't come here and just sit and absorb. You actually learn some of the concepts and some of the lists. We're coming from a very scholastic tradition. I'll say more about that in a minute. So there are all kinds of things that one can learn, and it really is very, very helpful to learn them, because then they become accessible to you in your day-to-day life. That makes a huge difference. You aren't trying to think, okay, what was that teaching? It's and so it's a very old-fashioned thing that I'm talking about. It's memorization. I don't expect you to memorize 10 pages a week or anything like that, but there are a few key things which will be just very helpful to commit to memory, so that when you're thinking about them, you actually don't have to keep looking them up and reading them, trying to remember what they are. You can actually just think about them. And the second thing that I expect is that you actually do think about this stuff. You may want to do some extra reading from time to time, get different perspectives. The internet is an extraordinary resource because there is just so much stuff up on this, even in these relatively esoteric areas. And the key thing is, does this make sense? And if it doesn't make sense, then why doesn't it make sense? And it's those kinds of questions that I want you to bring to the class. So this isn't just a one-way street where I'm giving you material, but you're actually thinking about this quite actively, and you say, you know, this doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand this. And so we can have a discussion about that. Practice isn't basically your responsibility. I suggest that you practice at least half an hour a day, better 40 minutes to an hour, but half an hour is really the minimum. Whatever form your practice takes, it is going to help you very significantly in absorbing and being able to make use of the material, because it is through practice that we get a somewhat quiet mind. And the quiet mind is one which understands things. The quiet mind becomes naturally clear, and that clear, quiet mind naturally understands things much more than the busy, intellectual, thinking mind. In some ways, it's a different kind of understanding, an understanding that a lot of people in this culture are not used to, but it's a far stronger, far deeper, far more vibrant understanding. And that's, again, why I recommend this, because it has the practice. You'll also find resources for practice on the Unfettered Mind website and the practice study guide. Now, in terms of what we're going to actually be doing, we're going to cover what's a fairly large section of Tibetan Buddhism. It's by no means all of it. We're not going to be dealing very much with what's called Vajrayana. Going to be dealing with mainly the Mahayana, or Sutrayana as it's called, and in a way that was characteristic of the Tibetan tradition, a genre of literature which was called Lam Rim. That, for those of you who are interested in that, it's Lamrim. Usually put together as one word, so you can, or sometimes separate it into two. You can look it up on Google. You'll get a bunch of stuff. Lam is the word for path. Rim is the word for stages. So it's literally the stages of path. Basically, it's just a sequence of teachings which set out the whole path. And it was a genre of literature that was initiated in Tibet by a figure called Atisha, who came to Tibet in 1042. He was one of the... Well, he was the leading Indian master, basically somewhat like the Pope of Buddhism in India at that time. And he'd been invited numerous times and consistently turned them down because Tibet, as far as the Indians were concerned, was a land of barbaric savages. But circumstances conspired so that Atisha finally acceded to these invitations. He came in the 11th century and taught there for the rest of his life. But part of it was writing a book which became the model for a very large genre of Tibetan literature. There are innumerable texts which set out the stages of the path. The one we're going to focus on is the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Now, for the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, there are now two translations in English, this one and this one. And there are pros and cons in both. This one was made in the late 50s by an Austrian scholar named Gunther, who I had the occasion to meet, a very wonderful, kind, generous person, and smart as hell. He there was no concept too easy that he couldn't make difficult. But he was a traditional European philosopher who decided that he wanted to convey the depth of Tibetan thinking in the West when it was regarded as pretty primitive, and this is the late 50s or early 60s. So this is one of his first translations. The English is very, very difficult because it's a second language and he's writing very scholastically. The big thing about this is the footnotes are absolutely full of really useful information. This this translation is made by a Tibetan lama named Khenchok Jaltsen, who speaks English quite well. It's also been heavily edited, so it's quite readable. The very nice thing about this, is, in addition to it being readable, is that it includes a whole bunch of the stories which the author of this text, Gampopa, whom I'll get to in a minute, alludes to, but they're all included in the appendix, so you can actually, it fills in all the gaps, basically, which is very nice. Both books, as most of the stuff that is in English, have serious translation problems, and that's my job, is to help clean up those translation problems. Another book, which deals with the same material, it's a commentary on a 17th century teacher, Jigme Lingpa, by a contemporary teacher, Khandur Rinpoche. This covers much the same material in a somewhat different way, just very, very readable. It's called The Treasury of Precious Qualities. There are two books by that title. This is the commentary on Jigme Lingpa by Khandur Rinpoche. And these are all on the recommended reading or suggested reading on the website. Third book is third, fourth, fifth, sixth, I don't know which. Words of My Perfect Teacher. This is not exactly a lamrim. This is one of the central texts in the Nyingma tradition. It occupies basically the same position in the Nyingma tradition as this jewel ornament does in the Kagyu tradition. This is quite a good translation. It's a very, very famous text, mainly because this is the text from which all the lamas draw all their stories. So whenever lamas are telling stories, you can almost count on finding it somewhere in this thing. A much lesser known book is one written by one of my teachers, Three Levels of Spiritual Perception, by Dejung Rinpoche. I'm not sure how available this is. Dejung Rinpoche was one of the great master scholars. Whenever you asked him a question, you had to be prepared for a two-hour answer. It didn't matter what the question was. I mean, he was just such a wonderful source of information. Very, very warm person. And this is written very simply, very nicely. Covers, again, the same material. Three Levels of Spiritual Perception. Now, in terms of resources, anybody who's taking this class, if you aren't already, I want you to enroll on Facebook. Facebook. Yeah. Facebook has changed. Your teenager will die. Look, Steve Chase and people are on Facebook, so... Facebook's changed, and it's become a very convenient site for networking, basically. I've set up a group on Facebook specifically for this class. It's called Then and Now. Now, that's run together because when I had it typed in as Then and Now separate things, then just couldn't find it because the words were too common. So Then and Now without any spaces, and you'll be able to find it quite easily. You can enroll in the group. I'm going to use that to put list these kinds of resources so you don't have to take notes, etc., and to give you updates on the class and things like that. But it's also a place for you to throw up questions and things like that. And if you come across stuff in your own studies and research which are interesting, you can put links to it there and then everybody in the class. So we're just going to use Facebook as a community resource for this class. And you can, you know, send a friend request to me or whatever, you know, just on it goes.
Is this a wiki?
No, Facebook is a commercial site. It's, and it originally started as a way for high school and college people to connect with each other, things like that. But it's expanded hugely beyond that. It's a very well designed and much cleaner interface than MySpace. Basically... I mean, where's Deborah? There she is. We had a meeting the other day, and she just said, Deborah said, Facebook, no way. What's your attitude to Facebook now?
I'm wasted, but I'm on it.
Yeah, a little more than on it. So anyway, at some point I want to set up that kind of... community site for Unfettered Mind, but we aren't there yet. So I'm just going to make use of stuff that's free and available, and it works. So, but that's where I'm going to be putting stuff, and you know, so you can keep tabs on the class from there. The other thing is that in your reading, if in the internet, as I say, any of the stuff that we discuss in this class, you'll be able to type stuff into Google, and you'll just get bunches of stuff because there's really, really a lot of stuff up. And if you find something that is particularly interesting or think that may posted in the link section in the class group, and then everybody will be able to benefit from it. Okay. Those are those two sections. Now, the actual structure of the class each evening, my plan is that we do half an hour of meditation, just as we did this evening, an hour of covering material, and then a half an hour for questions and discussions. For this, I really encourage everybody to be here on time. Actually, Susan, if you're doing the bell, what I'd like you to do is to ring the gong about five times at 7:25, which can be a signal for everybody to get in their places so we can really start right at 7:30 so we aren't starting late. We started on time this evening, and that was good. Is that okay with you? Great. Thank you. And so I'm going to try and be quite prompt because we all have busy lives. You can end at 9:30 so you know we aren't going to go off into midnight and burn the midnight oil. I don't know, are there any other logistic points we should cover? I think that takes care of the logistics. So the next thing I want to do this evening, very briefly, is to go into a little bit more context. The book that we're going to be working with principally is The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Again, either of these two translations. This is the more readable one, but it's your choice which you get, or you can get both. I have a copy of the Tibetan, if anybody wants it. Well, sure. It's there's actually two books in here. There's the Jewel Ornament of Liberation and then Filling in the Gaps of the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. But this is not the copy that I read originally back in the early 70s when I learned Tibetan, but that's what it looks like. And it says right there, Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Pardon? You'll take a word. Okay. But the reason I've dug this out is so that as we're going through this, I can actually check the Tibetan and possibly clear up any confusion by referring to the actual source. Joe?
Since we're on books, do you have any comments or
familiarity? Yeah. I ordered this and took a quick look at it. And unfortunately, I opened it at a page where I read something which I just thought was wrong. but this is kind of a... Pardon? Path to Buddhahood, it's a series of teachings on the jewel ornament of liberation. Basically, he takes the six topic areas and gives a lecture on each one. And I'm sure most of it is fine. It's like a summary of the book. Okay. The jewel ornament of liberation is part of a genre of literature which I've referred to already as Lamrim. And there are innumerable Lamrim texts. In the Gelugpa tradition, you have the Lamrim, the great Lamrim, which is like huge, and then you have the short Lamrim, which is better. But I know of probably 10 different Lamrim texts. They all cover essentially the same material, which is where Buddhism had evolved to in India up to the 10th or 11th century. That's what Tibetan Buddhism is based on. Now, we have to look at that. Buddhism started 500 BC, or 500 BCE. So you're looking, Tibetan Buddhism in this formulation is starting 1,500 years later. That's a long time. So there, things had been thought through and evolved and chewed, and teachings had been developed and lost countless times during those centuries. And as tends to happen with spiritual traditions over time, particularly in medieval cultures, because this is really medieval India we're talking about, the monasteries became the repositories of learning, and so there is a great deal of emphasis on scholasticism and reason and logic and all of that. So that is one of the reasons why Tibetan Buddhism has a very academic tone to it. An academic tone which is really quite out of sync with most people's interest in it today. They aren't interested in learning lots of stuff. They want to learn how to practice and approach this in a way that is directly relevant to their lives. And that's very much how I'm going to try to approach this. The author of the text is a person called Gampopa, who is also known as the doctor from Dokpo. Dokpo is a certain region of Western Tibet, I believe. And his story is, he's a very important figure in Tibetan Buddhism for a number of reasons. He started off as being trained as a physician. He was a very, very skilled doctor. He was married, had a couple of children, and his two children and his wife all died of diseases in which he was unable to cure them. And his wife died extremely painfully. And this was very, very difficult for him, as any of you know, when you have a loved one who is dying and there's nothing you can do about it. That is really, really difficult. And through this experience, he just felt that life had no meaning. So he just gave up his medical practice and entered a monastery and turned to spiritual practice. And he trained for many years as a monk and became a very, very well-regarded scholar. But that path did not answer his deep spiritual questions, even though he was regarded as a great teacher by virtue of his study and mastery of the material. And his spiritual quest led him to give up that his place in the monastery and journey to meet another teacher, a person called Milarepa, who was a mountain yogin, who lived in the mountains of Tibet, and such was so powerful was his practice that he just wore a cotton sheet in, you know, these very cold, snowy regions. And Gampopa became his principal disciple. And the reason he's regarded as a pivotal figure is he took these two traditions, the scholastic monastic tradition and the mountain yogin tradition, and brought which are regarded as two rivers, and brought them together, which became the basis for a large number of transmissions in the Tibetan tradition, what are called the Dakpo Kagyu, Dakpo after this Gampopa. And there are several lines of transmission, some of which are extant today, like the Kama Kagyu and the Drupa Kagyu and so forth. So here we have a highly trained scholastic who also has developed yogic abilities in isolated practice in the mountains, and this is what he puts together as the basis for practice. And so that's what we're going to take a look at. Now this evening, what I want to deal with is just the introduction, which is just a very few, basically a page and a half, if that. The principal challenge that I find we face in looking at Tibetan Buddhism is that since it developed when Buddhism had been around for 1,500 years already, we have extremely well-formulated answers to spiritual questions. And the questions aren't actually named. So we're going to play a little Jeopardy here. You know, what are the questions? Because spiritual practice always starts with certain questions. And this is something that I would like you to reflect on as you approach this text, as you approach this class. And I want you to reflect on this in two ways. One, what are your spiritual questions? Which is, to put it very simply, why are you here? You know, what are the questions that you're looking for answers to? And so that's one thing. And keep bringing that to mind so that when you're reading this, you say, okay, what relevance does this have for the questions that I'm working with? And if you can't see that relevance, then what I'd like you to do is to ask and say, this is the question that I have. You know, does this particular teaching or where in this is there some kind of response to that? And I'd really like you to be active participants in that way. Then the second way that I'd like you to reflect on this is that everything that we go over, and I'll be doing this very much with you, is okay. What is the spiritual question for which this is this is an answer? I don't want to say it is the answer because there are many possible answers, but what is the spiritual question for which this is an answer? And I found that this is a very interesting way of reading some of these texts, rather than just saying, okay, these are the teachings, now you just understand them, is to come back, okay, what are the questions that motivated this? And that's what I want to try to go over with you this evening. So, in every Tibetan text that I know of, it always starts off with an homage. Here the homage is, I prostrate to the noble Manjushri in youthful form. I pay homage to the victorious ones, their followers, the holy Dharma, and to the lamas who are their foundation. This noble teaching, which is like the wish-fulfilling jewel, will be written for the benefit of myself and others by depending on the kindness of Mila and Lord Atisha. Now, one of the things that you may come to appreciate here is that whoever they pay homage to tells you something about the text. Here it's being, the homage is being paid to Manjushri. Manjushri is a 10th level bodhisattva who is regarded as the embodiment of awakened intelligence. So that tells you right away that this is a scholastic treatise. This is about it's about wisdom. It's about knowing stuff. Other texts will start, pay homage to Avalokiteshvara, who's the embodiment of awakened compassion. They have a very different tone to them. They're very different subject matter. Here it's to Manjushri. And then the victorious ones is an epithet for the Buddhas, their followers, the Bodhisattva, the holy Dharma, the teachings, and to the Lamas, which is acknowledgement of the Sangha. These are the three jewels. So that's who he honors. And then he declares his intention. This noble teaching, which is like a wish-fulfilling jewel, is written for the benefit of myself and others, and depending on the kindness of Mila and Lord Atisha. So he's referring to the two streams of his training. Lord Atisha is what gave rise to the scholastic tradition and the monastic tradition in Tibet, in the new school. And so he's acknowledging Atisha there and all that whole sequence of Lamrim texts. And he's also acknowledging Milarepa, who is his, I would say, principal teacher, one from whom he came to, through whom he came to the deepest realization. Now, the first sentence is very simple. In general, all phenomena are included in the two categories of samsara and nirvana. Right here, we run into two different problems. One is a fairly serious translation problem, which I want to talk about. And the second is two technical terms, samsara and nirvana. Let me first talk about the translation problem. All phenomena. Now, the word here in Sanskrit is dharma. In Tibetan, it's chu. And it's usually translated as phenomena. But phenomena is not really accurate because phenomena refers to the objective pole of experience. What this word dharma refers to is experience. Now, there are two different aspects to experience. I experience objects out there, but I also experience a subject, like me, I. Anybody else have that experience? Okay. And so it isn't just what is perceived, it's also the experience of perceiving, of knowing. So I prefer to translate that word as experience. And so I would say all experience rather than all phenomena. If you want to cross that out in your text and write it in, that's just fine by me. So all experience, and again we have are included. This again is a what I call the idiocies of Buddhist English. Where people translate very literally without really paying attention to English idiom. We have the two categories of samsara and nirvana. Now, he's going to go through and explain what samsara and nirvana are. But basically what he's saying is all experience can be divided into two categories, samsara and nirvana. What does he mean by this term samsara? Now, the term samsara literally means cycle. It's a cycling or cycle, not in the terms of bicycle, but something that goes round and round. And nirvana literally means passing beyond misery. That's its literal meaning. Samsara refers to how we ordinarily experience things in terms of subject-object duality and all the confusion that arises from that. Nirvana, as he's using it here, refers to experiencing things without that confusion, which is not how it's used in a lot of other contexts. That's one of the other things we'll be faced with, is the fact that words are used differently in different contexts. Then he goes on to say, that which is called samsara is empty by nature. It's a confused projection. Its defining characteristic is that it manifests as suffering. That which is called nirvana is also empty by nature, but all the confused projections are exhausted and dissipated. Its defining characteristic is freedom from all suffering. Now, having read that, what is the spiritual question that is being this is an answer to?
Could it be emptiness?
No, that's more part of the answer. Oh, by the way, do we have the microphones here? Yeah. Because this is podcast, we'd like you to use the microphones, and that way people can hear things. So, now, any ideas about what the spiritual question here is? Let me read it again. That which is called samsara is empty by nature, a confused projection. Its defining characteristic is that it manifests as suffering. That which is called nirvana is also empty by nature, but all the confused projections are exhausted and dissipated. Its defining characteristic is freedom from all suffering. So, Chuck, Joe, could you pass one of the mics to Chuck there?
I would say it answers the question, what is experience?
Okay. Art?
What is the cause of suffering, or why is there suffering?
Yeah. So I think I think both of these are good candidates. Okay, if we take Chuck's suggestion a step further, it's like, okay, what is life? Because that's a fairly deep question. You know, what is this experience we call life? And if we take Art's contribution, it's okay. I experience suffering in life. Why? Right? Why is it this way? So this is where our starting point is. We have this experience. Do you understand this experience of life? No? I've always recall a radio interview I translated for Kala Rinpoche, my teacher in Canada, in which the interviewer started off with the question, Rinpoche, what is the meaning of life? And I tried to translate this, and I quickly wound up tied up in knots because I could not convey that question in Tibetan. So I interrupted the interview and said, can we start again? Fortunately, it was being taped. It wasn't live. That would have been very embarrassing. And then I just translated it. And Rinpoche's reply was, life is the time between birth and death. And I just let the interviewer, who was a very skilled interviewer, struggle with it. And by the end of the interview, which is half an hour, he was just sweating. Because there's these different ways of interpreting things. But I realized we couldn't ask this question. I couldn't ask this question in Tibetan. What is life? What is this experience we call life? What's going on here? We are born here. We come into this world of experience. Things rarely go according to plan. it seems to be far harder than it actually needs to be, consistently. And that isn't something that's particularly true of this age. That goes back, you know, thousands of years. What's going on here? This is what I want to suggest, that where Gampopa is starting. That because this has been chewed and chewed and chewed over hundreds of years, he's just already starting with a kind of answer rather than the question. Okay. Then he says, okay, one aspect of our life is that we suffer. Now, the word for suffering in Sanskrit is dukkha. And basically, while it's generally translated as suffering, it covers everything from mild discomfort, physically or emotionally, to torture, to extreme agony, physically or emotionally. And lately I've been experimenting with a different way of talking about it. How many of you struggle in your life? Okay. I'm going to suggest that's what this term refers to. Okay? So when he says, that which is called samsara is empty by nature, a confused projection, its defining characteristic is that it manifests as struggle. Okay? So whenever you find yourself struggling in life, you're experiencing what Gampopa is referring to as samsara. Okay? And I really want to underline this. A lot of people think of samsara as life in the city and nirvana as life in nature. This is, no. Wherever you're struggling, that's samsara. By contrast, how many of you experience situations, interactions with a friend or others, where things have just flowed extremely easily? There's absolutely no sense of struggle. You don't feel, it goes so far as you don't feel separate from things. You don't have a really strong sense of I. You're just there. Anybody have this kind of experience? Okay. I want to suggest that's what they're talking about when they say nirvana. Okay? So we have these two contrasting things. One is struggle, and the other is this flow or peace or no sense of separation, openness. I mean, there are all kinds of words we can come with it. So the rest of this is like, how does this come about? So he's asking us, who is it that is confused in samsara? His answer is, all sentient beings of the three realms are confused. Now, again, what's the question here? In a certain sense, it's like, what am I? Okay, I experience struggle, I experience confusion. Where does that come from? Why do I have to deal with it? And he gives all of these answers, which are very good answers, but they're a little removed from our own experience. Because he says, where does the confusion come from? His answer, confusion comes from emptiness. Now, how helpful is that as an answer? You're laughing. I mean, is it helpful? I want to suggest that it's extremely helpful. Because when he says, the confusion comes from emptiness, he's saying, in effect, it isn't something that is fixed. It doesn't, you know how that sense of struggle can seem like solid, like everything, like it's carved in stone, like there's no possibility of working with it. Anybody have that sense of things? Okay. So when he says it's coming from emptiness, he says that way of perceiving things is not true. One way, Trungpa, and I think other teachers have said this, that what's being said here is all situations are workable. There isn't anything we experience which isn't workable. It may be extremely difficult, but everything is workable. That's quite a profound statement. Pardon?
Except the IRS.
You got tax troubles lately, Pat? Now, the next question, where does this confusion come from? And he comes up with another really helpful answer. It comes from great ignorance. Okay, what's he talking about here? I want you just to sit quietly for a moment. And then ask yourself the question, what am I? What happens when you ask that question?
You get really confused.
You get really confused. Okay, please use mic so this can go on, but it's fine. You get really confused, Randy. Anybody else? Chuck, do you have a mic there? Or
I asked somebody that was very knowledgeable, a geisha, and he just said, bad question.
Yeah, but what happens when you ask that question? When you ask that question of yourself?
Oh. Well, I've thought about what geisha said for 2 or 3 years, and I have no idea. I have no idea.
Okay. And that's what happens. When we ask that question, we have no idea. Okay? That's what Gampopa is referring to as great ignorance. I don't think it's a bad question at all. I think it's a great question because it puts us right in touch with the central problem of our life. We do not know what we are. And when we look, we have no idea. That's very significant. And what Gampopa is saying here is we struggle in life because we don't know what we are. Is this making a little more sense now? Okay, let's continue. How does this confusion operate? It operates through the activities and experiences of the six realms of migrators. I think this is a terrible translation. I'm sorry, Kentrop Johnson. Let's take another look at that. We have this confusion. We have this struggle. What does it look like? Okay. How many of you experience anger? Okay. Anger. What does the world look like when you experience anger?
Struggle.
But in particular, it looks like everything's against you. Okay? How many of you experience greed? Well, or we'll take a slightly less pejorative term, neediness. Okay, so there's some of you who aren't holding up your hands, but I know you do. I can just ask, you know, how many of you are trying to get your emotional needs met? See, everybody has to hold up their hands for that one. So we experience neediness. When you experience neediness, how does the world appear to you?
Something you get.
Pardon? It isn't there, and you know the world's not supplying it. If it was supplying it, you wouldn't feel needy, right? How many do things on autopilot or instinct? Okay. When you function on autopilot or instinct, how does the world appear to you? Yeah. How many of you saw the movie Thank You for Smoking? Okay. There's a perfect line here. Because everybody's asked, you know, why are you doing this after they do something particularly horrible? And the reply is always, I'm just trying to pay my mortgage. Okay? This is survival mentality. This is doing things on autopilot. They aren't really thinking about the implications. They're just trying to get by. It becomes the rationale for everything. I'm just trying to pay my mortgage. So that's that kind of automatic approach to things. How many of you like to have fun? How many of you work hard at your jobs so you can have a bit of fun? Okay? You don't get often get a chance because you don't get much vacation time, etc. But we try to do that. Now, how does the world look like? What does the world look like to you when you're trying to have fun? It's okay. There's just not enough time, right? Then how many of you like to, are a bit competitive? Jealous, okay, envious or whatever, okay? How many of you are trying to get ahead in your life? Okay, yeah, all right. So, and what does the world look like then? Well, you got to get your elbows out, right? You got to make things happen. Right, Jessica? So, and this is all because there's a sense of deficiency. I'm not enough just as I am. And how many of you, this may not be so true for a lot of people here, but I think we all experience this. How many of you have experienced having a certain amount of comfort in your life and you just like to try to hold on to it? Yeah, okay, that's okay. So what I've run through here are the six realms. The hell realm, the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, the human realm, the titan realm, and the god realm. And we're going to go through these in much more detail later. But this is what our life consists of all of these kinds of struggles, you know, opposing things, trying to get what we need, trying to achieve things so we can feel like we're better than we do right now, and so forth. This comprises the struggle of life. Okay? And that's what he's saying here. How does this confusion operate? It operates through the activities and experience of these six realms. That's what this confusion looks like. How can we understand this confusion? Okay. How many of you remember your dreams? Okay. In a dream, does everything appear real?
Yes.
Yeah. It may be somewhat more fluid than it is right now, but while you're dreaming it appears really real. You know, one of the great teachers of the 19th century had a dream in which he was being chased by a lion, and he ran into a temple where one of the ancient heads of that tradition was sitting on a throne, laughing his head off, and said to this guy, says, "You can't be any great lama if you don't even know that you're being chased by a lion in a dream and you're this frightened." And then he woke up from the dream. But during the dream, it feels very real. How do you know you aren't dreaming right now? Now, this actually is a deep philosophical question. There is no way to know. You know, in the ancient thing, how do we know we aren't a dream in the mind of God? We don't know. There is no way of telling. That may be a little disturbing to you, but there is no way of telling. When I was in the three-year retreat, this was made very, very clear to us because the retreat schedule is pretty demanding. And basically you're functioning on 4 to 5 hours sleep because you, a night, six if you're lucky. And you're meant to be resting in your meditation, but you know, you get tired. And several of us experienced this. We'd wake up and we'd set up the offerings, which is part of the morning ritual, and start doing our prayers and things like that. We were all in our individual rooms, and that'd be going quite nicely. And then we'd wake up. And we'd go, what? You know, because the offerings wouldn't be done, things like that. But it was just like, several times, I had to wake up twice. And there was no way, in the first wake up, I was actually dreaming. But I had no idea that I was dreaming. And then I'd actually wake up and go, huh. So we don't know. And that's what this confusion is like. We experience all of this stuff. It feels so real. We act as if, you know, this is it. But we really don't know what the hell's going on at all. And the only thing we know is that we struggle. Well, it's a couple other things we know, but I'll get to those in a minute. Now, he says, what is the error of this confusion? I would translate that as, what is the problem here? And the problem is that experience, as it says, all experiences are suffering, and say, we struggle. That's what the problem is. If it wouldn't matter if we were confused, if we had a good time being confused, but we don't. Now, the next is what an attorney would call a leading question. When can this confusion be transformed into primordial wisdom? Well, he's making the assumption it can be transformed into primordial wisdom. That's a very powerful thing. Okay, so here I think the question that's being asked is, can we do anything about this confusion? He's already assumed the answer, but is there anything we can do about this confusion? And the answer in Buddhism is actually, yes, there is. There is something we can do. We do not actually have to live in confusion. That's one of the central principles of Buddhist practice. And it's probably why most of you are here this evening, because you experience struggle in one form or another. You're here just out of the remote possibility that it's actually possible to do something about it. And then a very key point, and Gunther has a much better translation here. If you think this confusion will disappear by itself, remember, samsara is notorious for being without end. This is, in all the work that Gunther's translated, that's his best line. It's a little free translation, but it's got a nice ring to it. This is a very important statement. The question here is, well, what if I don't do anything? I just go on, just live my life. And the answer, that's the question. Why do I have to do anything about this confusion? Do I need to do anything about it? And the answer is, if you don't do anything about it, it's just going to go on forever. Now, suddenly that doesn't sound so cool. I mean, if it's just like for a day or two or, you know, a year or so, that would be fine. But to put it another way, there is nothing within this confused experience which is naturally going to lead to it clearing up, ending. In other words, we have to take responsibility for our experience. So this is actually very, very powerful stuff that he's saying here. And when you contrast this with a lot of other spiritual traditions where there's the whole notion of being saved or being taken care of and everything, if you live a certain way, then everything will be taken care of for you. In Buddhism, we don't have that idea at all. Whether you are awake or asleep is entirely up to each of us individually. There's a very, very powerful, very strong principle of taking responsibility for one's life, for one's experience, for how one's experiencing things. A question? Yeah. Jessica, you had a...
Kind of. It's a little bit bit of an offshoot, but maybe it's okay for me to ask. Why is it that when you practice for a while and you stop practicing, the energy that you've built up in the practice then goes back into that cycle even worse?
Well, you can think of it, I think plumbing is a good example.
What is
plumbing? Or electricity, okay? Yeah, I think electricity is a good example. You put a lightning rod on top of your house to lead the electricity down into the ground. And practice, in a certain sense, is a way of grounding us very, very profoundly. Okay? Now, suppose you leave that nice iron spike on top of your house, but you break the connection with the ground. Now what happens?
I don't know, but it's not good.
Well, lightning is far more likely to strike your house and kaboom. So when you build up some energy and you're no longer making an effort in attention, that energy is going to go somewhere. And it's just going to flow where there's habituated patterns. But because there's more energy in the system, the habituated patterns are going to be stronger. You follow? And your question is quite relevant here because Gampopa just said samsara doesn't dissolve itself. So we start working on it. And it becomes important, once you start working on it, to complete the process, because otherwise you end up worse than before.
Well, when you say complete the process,
what does that mean, really, completing the process?
Well, I think there are different stages of completion, but at the very least, come to a point where there is a self-sustaining shift in the system.
Okay.
Now, what Gampopa does now is lay out the basic structure of the text. Says, okay, this is what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about this problem of confusion and struggle and what to do about it. And he's going to talk about what to do about it using the following framework. And the words here are primary cause, working basis, contributory cause, method, result, and activities. I would offer these as the genesis of the practice. What makes it possible for us to do something about it? So that's what I'm translating as genesis. It's usually translated as primary cause. I just don't like that translation in English for reasons I'll go into next week probably. So how is it possible for us to do something about it? What is it about our experience that makes it possible to do something about? That's what the first big topic is. Then the next topic is, what do you need to work on it? What do we actually need? That's like the working basis or the framework. Then what helps, what other things do we contributory cause, like what are the conditions? And then how do we actually do it? How do we actually make this transformation? What does the result look, and what happens when, you know, what does life look like when you've gone through this process? Now, he answers these. The genesis, or the primary cause, is what is known as Buddha nature. In Sanskrit, Tathagatagarbha. It's a very interesting idea, and that will be the subject of our class next week, is this notion of Buddha nature, what it is. What makes it possible, is what makes it possible for us to be able to move out of struggle and move out of confusion. Then what do we need to do that? We need to have certain conditions in our life as human beings. So that'll be a second topic. What makes it all come together is instruction and guidance from a person that's qualified and able to do that. So there's a discussion on the spiritual teacher or the spiritual master. And then how do we actually do it? By working with those teachings. And that comprises the bulk of the book, is all the stuff, all the different methods. And what is the result? The result of this is that we wake up from this ignorance, and that's what Buddhahood is. That's the result. We wake up in our lives. And then finally, the last thing is, what does life look like when you're awake? And that's the final chapter. So, and what life looks like is that we work for the benefit of beings. So you can see in what we've gone over that in this introduction, he's laying a foundation by looking at the central problem of human existence. We struggle, and he says we struggle because we don't know who we are, and because of that confusion, we have difficulties in our lives. That confusion is not going to resolve itself. It's only going to be resolved if we make certain efforts. And what he's going to describe are all of the different things that need to come together in order to make those efforts. So, and that's going to be our subject matter for the next few weeks. Okay. So at this point, I'd like to throw it open to questions in the times that we have remaining. Linnea, microphone, please.
I feel like this is a little bizarre, but what is a spiritual question?
Oh, you know, just the Japanese have a nice, very nice phrase for this. The great matters of life and death. Okay, I mean, you can call it existential questions. You know. Who am I? What am I? Where do I come from? What's going to happen to me? In the ultimate sense, okay? Those are the things I'm, you know, how do I know what's right to do? So there's a whole bunch of moral questions that come in. Questions of that order is what I'm referring to as spiritual questions. Not, does that answer your question?
It does. It just seems sometimes like there's only one question.
Which is?
What is this? Or, I mean, that's maybe just my question.
The question, yes, well, I think that's very good. That is the question which forms the basis of practice in the Korean Zen tradition. I don't know, in my apartment, you may have seen that calligraphy I have in the hallway, which is just an enso with what is this in Chinese and English. It's by Sung Sin Im, did that. And that's exactly right. What is this? Well, right now what this is an experience of struggle, right? Okay. Where does that come from? And then it just leads into all of the other questions. Okay, thank you. Kate?
In In a lot of teachings and books that you pick up, you know, you start, when you get the basics of Buddhism, it would be the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path.
Yes.
And obviously I can see that there's, you know, this is really all the same material, but I'm just curious about why this isn't presented in that, you know, similar way.
That's a very, very good question. The Noble Eightfold Path comes up in like chapter 22 or no, I think it's like 24 or something like that. It's right at the end of the book. And the Four Noble Truths come up somewhere back there in terms of when you move into the understanding. It describes a very detailed process by coming to understand the Four Noble Truths. And anything I say in response to your question is speculation, but I think that it is the difference between traditions which took the early teachings and just stayed with them, and the Tibetan tradition, which, as I described before, built on 1,500 years of evolution within India, in which things were worked and reworked so that they really came to a different starting point. One of the difficulties with the Tibetan tradition is it's so self-referential, as you can see just from these opening comments. You're assumed to know everything. And so they're talking about it in that way. So it's assumed that you know the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So we don't even need to worry about those. We can go straight to what is this? What is this experience? And what do we do about it? Now, as you said in your question, that's essentially what the Four Noble Truths are doing. The first truth is the truth of suffering, or, you know, there is struggle. And then where does the struggle come from? And can we do anything about the struggle? That's the third noble truth, the truth of cessation and so forth. But I can only surmise that it's just been worked and reworked, that didn't need to be talked about explicitly. It was just understood. But you're quite right. It's a very different way of formulating things compared to the Theravadan tradition, which is always about the Four Noble Truths. Okay. Agnes?
Are there, you know, differences really between Buddhism as 500 BC versus Tibetan Buddhism? Or it just, like you said, work, rework, but then why is we call Tibetan Buddhism because it's just from Tibet rather than, say, Cambodia Buddhism or, you know, others?
Well, this is a very interesting point. When you look at Buddhism in China, Tibet, I was going to say Japan, Vietnam, Sri Lanka, and Thailand. To the outside observer, you're dealing with really different religions, because you'll find almost no forms that are common in terms of rituals. In Thailand, they have the bathing of the Buddha. It's unknown in the Tibetan tradition. In the Tibetan tradition, you have these lama dances, unknown in the Theravadan tradition. It just looks like demon worship. In Zen, in Japan, you have people going around hitting each other. Unknown in Theravadan, not unknown in Tibet, but done very differently in Tibet. Nothing like the precision and formality in Japanese. So they really look like very, very different religions. Yet, when Buddhists from those different countries start talking with each other, they find that they're working with very, very similar material, some of it more elaborate, some of it less elaborate, but with very similar understanding. I mean, virtually the same understanding. When you contrast that with Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, which are totally comparable because they all stem from Abraham, they are one religion, and yet there's these tremendous difficulties and tensions among them in a way that just does not exist among the Buddhist traditions. So the reason that we call things Tibetan Buddhism and Cambodian and things like that is primarily because of the geographical isolation that these different Buddhist traditions experienced for hundreds of years, thousands really. And now that that geographical isolation has ended, there's a great deal of interaction taking place, which is very interesting. So we're seeing very different forms and emerge. But that's the primary reason, is because these are the ones associated with different countries.
Well, you were describing the difference seemed to be more the ritual. What about the essence, the Dharma itself? Does it have basic differences between these countries?
Not in my experience. I mean, there are some people who would say that Dzogchen and Theravadin are different religions. I don't buy it. I think they're different ways of talking about the same thing. The rituals and the forms that go with them are very, very different. To a certain extent, the spiritual ideals are different. That is, you have a different picture of what it may look like. But the actual experience and everything, I don't find those differences. I have a colleague who's very, very similar to me, except his training is all in the Theravadin tradition. But whereas I know Tibetan, he knows Pali, and he's put a lot of thought into translation. And we have very, very interesting discussions because the Theravadins are all set up as straw dogs in the Mahayana, you know, as the Hinayana. And I discovered, much to my amusement, the Mahayanists are set up as straw dogs. And so we have this one time you referred, oh, you Mahayana essentialists, which is like, you know, terrible thing to call a Buddhist, it's an essentialist. It's like, but we have virtually no differences in our understanding of what Buddhism is actually about and what the aim is. And he's evolved a way of teaching which is quite unique and which is different from, but is analogous to, the way I've evolved. And there's just that kind of commonality. Leslie.
When you were talking earlier about the confusion and great ignorance, and then it gave that instruction to ask, what am I?
Yeah.
And then use that as an example of what the great confusion is, or ignorance. It felt a little funny to me because in working with the practice and asking, and when you're sitting for a while and then you ask, you know, the question like what rests, or that kind of a question, it felt to me tonight like the same thing, and it doesn't feel confused to me. So
yeah, you're leaving out one small part of the equation here.
Which is that we weren't...
No, you've done quite a bit of practice, Leslie. You're not exactly a beginner.
Oh, okay, so, all right.
So you know when that question is asked, you work with it in a different way. You know how to connect, you know how to rest in that experience. And there's there's a knowing there which you're able to... appreciate, let's say, okay? So that question now functions for you in a very, very different way than it does for people who are who haven't explored any of this at all. And because when we're new to this, and we say, you know, what am I? It's like, I don't know, you know. And it's like, you know, it's a completely crazy making question. But we can learn how to be present in that confusion. And that's where we begin to discover the process of transforming that confusion into a form of knowing, which is what he's referring to as primordial awareness. And that actually is the answer to what do we do about all of this. But you're neglecting how much you've developed through your own practice there.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question.
Just a small question. You've referred to Buddhism as a religion.
Oh,
and I just wanted, it's probably too, maybe it's too long for the last question of the night, but could you comment on that?
Well, there's some people who like to make a distinction between established religions and spiritual practice, and I think it's fair. I'm speaking pretty generally, I mean, because there is this, Buddhism is regarded as one of the great religions of the world. I don't approach it as a religion in the sense, I don't approach it as a system of beliefs, which is how a lot of people think of religions, but as a set of tools for exploring and coming to know what this is, to pick up on Linnea's question. And that's one of the things that I really like about Buddhism, is it's primarily a set of tools that we use to explore our experience. And that's how I want to approach this class, is like, what are the questions that you have, that we have, and how do you explore them? How do you explore them in terms of possible answers? How do you explore them in terms of building the capacity and the skills you need to do that? And so this, we're using this material which has come down through the centuries, but we're using it to undertake our own spiritual exploration or journey into the questions that are important and relevant for us. That sufficient for you tonight? Okay. In terms of preparation for next week, I would like you to read the chapter on Buddha nature, which is the next chapter. And come with your questions. I have no idea whether we will get through the whole chapter next week. I'm going to play this very, very much by ear. We've got this room booked, I think, for, was it 15 we reserved it for? At least 12. Yeah, it's up to the end of January anyway. But I suspect we're going to go longer than that, and probably quite a bit longer. So we may spend 2 or 3 weeks on the next chapter. I doubt that we'll do it all in one. I would also invite you to read about Buddha nature, looking it up on the web. There are other books on it. The main sutra, which is sort of a sutra, is Uttara Tantra. Gunter footnotes it. It's been translated into English 2 or 3 times. I'll see if I can find an English translation. I'll put that up on the Facebook so that you can look that. That's it's of Trungpa Rinpoche has written their commentaries on it. In fact, you can look up Buddha. You can look up the term Buddha nature and find some of Trungpa Rinpoche's stuff on the web on it. But there'll be lots of other stuff. So I invite you to just to read about, explore this whole topic of Buddha nature. The Tibetan formulation or Gampopa's formulation actually is, again, in some sense, quite abstruse. So I'm going to try to make it translated into something that you can actually relate to. That's what we'll focus on next week. Okay? All right. Susan, dedication?